Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a visit to a shopping center that doubles as an immersive art gallery.
And what childcare that costs more than college means for the state's workforce.
But first, federal funding for people who need help paying to heat or cool their homes is in jeopardy. That's after the Department of Health and Human Services laid off the employees who work on the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP. The program has been around since the early 80s, and in the Valley, mainly helps residents afford their air conditioning bills during the summer. With me now to talk about this is Travis Madsen, Transportation Program Director for the Southwest Energy Efficiency Program, or SWEEP. Travis, good morning.
Good morning.
So what happened here? Just these folks who worked at Health and Human Services specifically on this program, they're just all gone now?
Yeah, the Trump administration laid off all the employees at the Department of Health and Human Services that manage this essential program, providing bill payment assistance to people across the country.
Has anybody said anything about whether these just happened to be, for example, probationary workers, or if this was an attempt to in some way really just shut down this program?
You know, I'm not sure whether this is an accident that the administration just stumbled into, or whether they're intentionally trying to dismantle the program. But either way, I'm concerned that, you know, if this program is not functioning, it'll put families in Arizona at risk.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, because as I mentioned, this is a program that helps folks specifically, you know, in the Valley. It helps people to pay their AC bills. In other parts of the country, it helps pay for heating bills during the summer. What kind of impact have you seen it have here in past years?
So in the last year, Arizona got about $30 million from the federal government to help needy families pay their energy bills. It's really important assistance because about 10% of the families in the Phoenix metro area spend more than 10% of their overall income on energy. That's a pretty severe strain on their budgets. And, you know, if they run into a situation where they can't pay their bills, it can create a financial emergency or increase the risk that they're exposed to extreme heat, which is a you know, deadly threat to people's health. It kills hundreds of people in the Phoenix metro every year.
Yeah.
So having this assistance available, you know, helps keep families stable and improves their quality of life. And I think it's an essential part of the safety net that keeps Arizona a livable place.
It's worth noting that folks in Arizona, mostly elected officials in Arizona over the past number of years, have been advocating for more money or more equitable division of the money, because traditionally the lion's share of LIHEAP money has gone toward like northeastern states or upper midwestern states to pay for a heating cost, as opposed to states, you know, in Arizona, New Mexico, Southern California to pay for cooling costs, right?
I certainly think that the need for bill assistance in Arizona is much higher than the funding availability has been. And it's not just LIHEAP that provides this assistance. There's programs that the utilities and local governments run as well. But the need is greater than the funding available. But if there's no staff working in the department managing LIHEAP, well, who are you going to go talk to about increasing Arizona's allocation?
Is it possible that this could be sort of shifted to another division within the Department of Health and Human Services, or maybe just moved to other employees and the program doesn't go away?
I hope so. The program was created by Congress in 1981, and President Reagan signed it into law. And it's, I think, been a bipartisan consensus for more than 50 years that providing energy bill payment assistance is in the best interest of America. And I hope that, you know, that this is just going to be a blip in the system, and that the department will reorganize the staff in charge of it. But I'm nervous. I think at minimum, this shows some reckless staffing decisions by the Trump administration.
What are you seeing from folks in D.C. about this? Because, you know, this is not just something, obviously, that affects Arizona or any particular state. Like, pretty much, I would imagine many, many states, if not all states, get some kind of funding from LIHEAP for either heating or cooling.
Yeah, this affects every state in the country. And I think Arizona, more than most, since it's the place where I think heat emergencies are the most common. I think Congress didn't authorize the program to stop. So by law, I think it needs to continue. And it's up to the Trump administration to make sure that it does. And if not, then Congress or the courts need to step in.
You alluded to this, but I want to ask you more specifically about other programs, other ways that folks who need this kind of assistance can potentially get it. And you mentioned that, you know, some utilities offer assistance. Like, are there other programs either on the state level or maybe even other levels of government that can supplement this or sort of make up for some of the loss of funding from LIHEAP if it, in fact, is not available?
Yeah, Arizona Public Service and Salt River Project both offer low-income rate assistance as well as programs to help families improve the energy efficiency of their homes. So if you're adding insulation and improving the air sealing of your home, it can cost less to keep it cool. Those are important programs, and I think the demand for those services is going to be even higher if there's a disruption in this federal assistance.
What is your level of optimism that this will get resolved and folks specifically in the Southwest and other parts of the country where it's getting really hot pretty soon will have that money?
I don't know. I think I've never encountered a situation like this where the entire staff of an important program has been laid off. So it's outside of my experience. I'm hopeful that it's an oversight, but I do not know for sure.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Travis Madsen, Transportation Program Director for the Southwest Energy Efficiency Project, or SWEEP. Travis, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mark, an important chapter in Tempe's architectural and artistic history may be coming to an end.
Indeed, there are potentially some big changes coming to Donnell Plaza, and you went over there recently, right?
That's right.
All right, so tell us what you saw.
In a nondescript outdoor mall at the corner of Mill and Southern, there's a shop window filled with a giant painting of blue mountains.
So this artist is J.J. Horner. So he actually lost his brother before he did this installation, and you can see the damage here.
That's Rob Moore. He's pointing to a spot behind the mountains in the lower left-hand corner of the canvas where there's a gaping hole.
And that actually reflects the trauma of losing his brother. If you look through the hole, you might catch a glimpse of something in the background.
All right, so I'm looking closer. Oh my God! Okay. Wow. Through the hole in the canvas, way towards the back of the empty room behind the painting, a hooded figure sits slumped on the floor, staring at the wall. The figure isn't real. It's a sculpture meant to represent J.J. Horner, the artist who painted the mountains. According to Rob, this entire installation is a reflection on the grief that J.J. Horner felt after the loss of his brother. This piece is just one of many on display here at Donnell Plaza, a series of empty retail stores that Rob has helped transform into a kind of alternative art gallery. Donnell Plaza was built in the early 1960s. For decades, the shop windows were filled with things like vacuum cleaners, shoes, and televisions. They were just regular stores. But that doesn't mean Donnell was a typical shopping center. For one thing, it didn't have a big anchor business like a grocery store. And on top of that, unlike most shopping centers, where businesses rent space from the owner of the full plaza, each store at Donnell was owned individually, which meant that the range of offerings at Donnell Plaza was pretty eclectic.
At one point, it had a skate park on site. It's had live music since its inception in the 1960s. It hosted Star System and Merlin's that were one of the Valley's first punk and new wave venues in the late 70s and early 80s.
For Rob, it's the music scene in particular that made him want to get involved in preserving Donnell's unique culture. Across the plaza from the window with the Blue Mountains is a rock club called Yucca Tap Room. Back in 2016, when many of the traditional retail businesses at Donnell had faded away, Rob came to a show at Yucca. And he noticed that there was a lot of action at Donnell that happened outside in the parking lot.
Seeing different bands talk between sets and exchange notes and explore ideas. And I overheard some conversations where you could tell they were basically experimenting, discussing what they were working on. And I realized what an important community space it was. And I recognized, you know, in these humble spaces were really important to the creative engine of the community.
Rob was on the Municipal Arts Commission at the time, and he decided he wanted to do something to support Donnell's creative spirit. So he and some fellow artistically minded Tempeans started a group called the Donnell Project. And for years now, they have invited artists to make large-scale installations in the empty retail spaces. In one of the smaller shops, there's a cluster of neon cacti with reflective surfaces.
It kind of is a glimpse into a dystopian desert world, if you will. And at night, it illuminates with black lights and LEDs.
There's also a big empty storefront with a long wall painted black and a very small painting of Donnell in the center. Another one features huge sculptures of animal feet plunging through the ceiling. And if you visit Donnell at night, it's just like Rob said. Music thumps behind the doors of Yucca Tap Room, and in the parking lot, bands and their fans laugh and joke next to the cars. Between sets, people wander over to the far side of the plaza to check out the art. This is what we want. But this version of Donnell Plaza isn't long for this world. The day I met Rob, he had just received an eviction notice. For the last few years, the city of Tempe has been leasing him the space at Donnell for free. But now the city has a development agreement in place for the plaza. Rob says that means a lot of the art will have to be taken down and relocated.
This was always intended to be a short-term experiment. This was a temporary concept that explored the ideas of what arts and culture might look like if they were incorporated into the long-term vision. In the development agreement that City Council approved, it emphasizes art, it emphasizes live music, it emphasizes recognizing the history of the plaza. And that's general guidance for what happens next within the redevelopment efforts. So in that sense, we've made a lot of progress, and we'll just have to see how that comes together.
In a statement emailed to KJZZ, the city says the Donnell Plaza development team has signed a new lease with a nonprofit called the Tempe Art and Music Coalition, which will, quote, support, create, and expand art incubation spaces throughout the city to create a robust, self-sustaining visual and performance art economy fed by a community that loves art for art's sake. The statement also says, quote, no art is being moved. As of this report, the specifics of the development plan for Donnell Plaza are unknown. Towards the end of my first visit to Donnell, Rob and I walked past a mural by Isaac Caruso. It's a painting of a woman's face, accompanied by the text of a poem. I asked Rob to read it.
And the text reads, as she grew older, her dreams never fading, she clung to her wonder and her mind for creating. People would sigh, she can't pay attention, but really her thoughts just had more dimension.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a play invites viewers into the legacy that violence holds over Black men in America.
But first, new numbers from a group called the Economic Policy Institute find childcare in a majority of states, including Arizona, is more expensive than college. The data for Arizona show the average cost for infant care is more than $15,000 per year. That number is closer to $12,000 a year for a four-year-old. Infant care does tend to be more expensive because of the lower ratio of professionals to infants. EPI finds the average annual cost for college here is less than $12,000. My next guest says these numbers generally mesh with what she sees. Melinda Gulick is CEO of First Things First, Arizona's early childhood agency, and says the average cost of childcare for a preschooler in Arizona is roughly $14,000 a year, although she has seen the cost for infant care as high as $25,000 a year. Gulick joins me to talk more about this. And Melinda, what do these numbers mean for Arizonans who are struggling to figure out if they can actually afford childcare?
Well, it's a very complex problem. So for working families, depending upon their income level as a family, there are three public programs that can provide support. The first one is Head Start, mm-hmm. and that serves families from 0 to 100% of the poverty level. The program with DES called Child Care Assistance serves families from 100 to 165% of the federal poverty level. And then First Things First scholarships is from 165, and some of our programs go up to 400% of the poverty level.
Okay.
Those programs are all limited in funding, and currently we have a waiting list for DES child care subsidy or child care assistance, and First Things First scholarships are fully subscribed. And so for a working family, finding child care is a really big challenge. It's also a challenge for employers. They lose really valuable employees. They have a high absentee program. The cost to replace employees is really expensive. And so we see that impacting the workforce and the economy as well.
And we've seen business groups in Arizona come out and say, look, we need to do something about this. We need more childcare subsidies. We need maybe more providers, high-quality providers. Does it seem as though anything is improving in this area? Like, are there more providers? Is there a way to maybe bring the cost down a little bit, or at least help subsidize people who can't afford those high costs?
So I think this is a challenge that we throw everything at, if that makes sense. We have public programs that support childcare, that support providers. We have an amazing partnership with the Arizona Chamber and other chambers mm-hmm. throughout Arizona who have really dug into this issue to see if there's a way employers can subsidize or provide discounts or provide grants to providers to really bring that cost down. We saw a package in the governor's State of the State. So it really is a throw everything at this and see how we can lower the cost of childcare, but also increase capacity.
In terms of folks trying to open either new classrooms within an existing childcare center or maybe open a new center, is this the kind of industry where the margins are really tight and it's just hard for operators to survive and even make some kind of a profit?
The margins, if you looked at a provider's business plan, you would say, why on earth did you get into this business? Because insurance costs are rising. Staff costs are really challenging. So we see the average child care, early childhood educator making about $14 an hour.
Wow.
No benefits, no paid time off, no paid professional development, no retirement included in that. And so imagine how hard it is to retain an employee in that scenario, but they have to keep that cost low because families can only afford so much. So it's really that balance. And the way we've seen it work most successfully is when they can scale over several centers and share those back office costs. But that's few and far between.
Is there a tipping point that we are coming onto in Arizona in terms of, as we've discussed, like sort of the lack of supply, the expense, and maybe the ability and or willingness of various public entities to help support these programs?
So in terms of a tipping point for Arizona in growing the capacity of childcare, reducing the cost of childcare, we see really good examples. For example, Pima County. They started with ARPA funds and they've leveraged county library funds to expand childcare in Pima County. That program is very responsive to the needs in Pima County. We are seeing task forces in Pinal County, Yavapai County, Yuma grow up in their own community. And this is very Arizona. How are we as our local community going to solve this for ourselves?
How concerned are you about the possibility of some of those public entities losing their funding to do this, either money that they get locally or money that maybe they get from the federal government?
Obviously, the federal funding situation is something we're watching very closely because child care assistance in Arizona, the program I talked about with DES, is funded by a federal block grant. Mm-hmm. And given Arizona's tax situation, if federal funding decreases and we have such a conservative tax policy in Arizona, we will have to have some very difficult conversations as a state. So we're watching it very closely. Right now, I think the future of childcare is, yes, public investment, yes, public attention on childcare and using public resources like excess facilities. Are there other ways that we could increase wages or provide benefits to childcare workers? Mm-hmm. But also there's the private sector's involvement in this.
Are you seeing that there are businesses that are just opening their own childcare facilities instead of worrying about what the overall system is like? Okay, here, employees, here's this system, this program where some I imagine you pay for, some maybe you don't have to pay for, but they just have it on site there for parents?
So we see two different models. I haven't seen any that are at no cost okay. to the employee, but USAA, for example, has an on-site childcare center. And they partner with a corporate private provider to
okay.
operate it. That's usually the best way to do it because it's USAA is not in the childcare business.
Right. You partner with somebody who knows what they're
who
doing.
Who knows what they're doing. Others, like Intel, have a partnership with a local provider where it's KinderCare. So Intel employees can get a discounted rate at KinderCare. We also see employers finding a resource for backup or after hours care, which is really interesting.
Do you envision in the going forward that more of those kinds of arrangements might come up, that businesses will be maybe a little more engaged specifically with their employees to either provide childcare or help their employees find it?
I think that's the future of employee retention. It's like, I think it will be an expectation that you have medical coverage, you have dental coverage, you have a retirement plan, and there is some arrangement for childcare. We're bringing in partnership with the Arizona Chamber and Four United Ways in Arizona, an organization called EPIC, which is out of Colorado, and it stands for Executives Partnering to Invest in Childhood. Hmm. And they specifically provide technical assistance for employers to solve their specific childcare challenge.
Interesting.
And they also work with collaborative groups to maybe you have four or five smaller employers, but who have a similar need, and then they'll help that coalition or that cohort of employers solve for the childcare need. And so I think we'll see a lot more employers engaging in this conversation because really, if we see the reasons people are leaving the workforce, 35% of people leave the workforce because of childcare issues. It's such a glaring reason people are either not accepting a promotion, reducing their hours, or missing work, or leaving a job altogether.
All right. That is Melinda Gulick, CEO of First Things First. Melinda, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Ira Hayes is arguably Arizona's most iconic World War II hero, as one of six Marines who famously raised the American flag at Iwo Jima. Hayes' decorated legacy was caught up in the recent scrubbing of DEI military history by the U.S. Department of Defense. Now some descendants are sharing his story from the Gila River Indian community. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has this report.
Am I able to touch this?
Yes. Help yourself
wow.
with it.
It's incredible. This rounded-edged dog tag was once worn around the neck of the famed Marine Corps hero, Corporal Ira Hamilton Hayes. Now his grandnephew, Wayne Allison, lets me hold this metallic relic of World War II history in my bare hands after taking it out of a black velvet ring box.
It's like a whole nother job when you want to come out and share what you got, you know, memorabilia. But even just to talk for family, it was so sensitive.
Allison, who has been a Hayes family rep since 2003, shows me their most coveted treasure at the communal plot in Casablanca, where all of Ira's relatives are buried. The stars and stripes flutter in the wind.
As a young man, I was taught, don't brag. Just know who we are and where we come from.
Doug Juan is also a nephew of Hayes. He remembers going to the Hayes household growing up until January 24, 1955, when he was only 5 years old.
Later on in life, I found out that it was the day that they found Ira.
Dead by age 32, a ballad sung by Johnny Cash even stereotypes his untimely passing.
He died drunk early one morning, alone in a land he fought to save. 2 inches of water in a lonely ditch was a grave for Ira Hayes. Call him drunken Ira Hayes, he will answer anymore. Not the whiskey drinking Indian or the Marine that went to war.
It's a reputation that still haunts the Hayes family.
We don't call him that. His name is Ira Hamilton Hayes. To them, it was normal. It was okay, like cool saying it. It's a perception.
One that Allison stresses shouldn't overshadow his heroism.
Maybe they don't see him as a war hero because of the way he died.
Last month, Democrats from Arizona's congressional delegation sent letters about the DEI directive, calling on the Defense Department to restore references of Hayes and Hopi Army Specialist Lori Ann Paestua, the first Native female soldier killed in action on foreign soil.
This needs to come back up, not just for us, but for Lori. I remember meeting her mom and the kids. Now they're all grown up.
Allison's 22-year-old daughter, Aaron, is next in line to carry on their family tradition.
He wants me to start this young. That way, nothing is ever forgotten.
And when she got the DEI news, it did not sadden or anger her.
Nor was my image of Ira. We know his story. It cannot be taken away. We are still here and still sharing his dog tag. I think that's the blessing to be Indigenous, one, and two, being related to him.
Like Hayes, Doug Juan also attended the Phoenix Indian School. He, too, went overseas. The Vietnam Army veteran is a member of American Legion Post 84, named after his renowned relative.
What we did in the service was protect this country, protect the Indian land, the people that live here, the elders, the children. But when they took down the information, it just bothered me.
Juan wonders why President Donald Trump ordered the removal.
He said he wants to be a dictator, and I kind of see that. We have been here a lot longer than he has.
With teary eyes, Wayne Allison says they cannot lose sight of Ira Hayes' legacy.
He is a hero to us. We should be proud as Pimas because one of our own was in a picture that that makes you look like it's free. We should be thinking that way. Yeah, we're in America, we're free. And we're not. It's not lost, but it's getting away from us.
And KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio joins us now in the studio. Gabe, good morning.
Morning, Sam.
Can you talk a little bit about that moment at the beginning of your piece where you held the dog tag? It seems like a lot of Ira Hamilton Hayes' legacy is contained in this physical object.
Yeah, for sure. I think the historic weight of that moment was weighing upon me. And to quote Indiana Jones, you feel like it's something that belongs in the museum, but it was better off in the family's hands. And I talked to Wayne after, and I said, gee, you must be concerned, you know, what happens when you go on, and where do you end up leaving the dog tag and the rest of your family's memorabilia? And he said, no, I'm not worried because I have my daughter and the rest of the family to carry on that story, to continue sharing his legacy.
Well, speaking of his legacy, it seems like there's sort of two levels to your story. There's the version of Ira Hayes that was memorialized in that song, and now there's been the removal of his name as part of the administration's anti-DEI crackdown. Was there a sense in the conversations you had that this was sort of an insult on top of injury moment?
I would say so. I think that Ira Hayes' legacy was already stained to some degree because of the Ballad of Ira Hayes song that was popularized by Johnny Cash, as you mentioned. And at the same time, it kind of left an impression that this was the stereotype and this perception, as Wayne mentioned in my conversations with him and other relatives and descendants. But at the same time, the legacy of his was also erased in part and edited and revised by the Defense Department. And so this was a double-edged sword in that sense.
So we hear this sentiment at the end of the piece from his nephew that the community has been there longer than President Trump has. And you've been reporting on the ways the anti-DEI crackdown has reverberated throughout the indigenous community. What did that moment with his nephew at the end make you think about in terms of these broader conversations that you've been having?
I think the biggest takeaway, what my conversation with Doug Juan was, that it reminded me that indigenous peoples have been serving in this country since the beginning of the founding of this nation, at the beginning of the American Revolution, all the way on. Indigenous peoples have served at high rates to defend this land, America, but not only this land, but Indian country, to protect their reservations and the people that they love as much as we do as non-natives. And so to me, it was really eye-opening and reminded me that this legacy has been here a lot longer than before Ira Hayes and will probably pursue after that.
Well, that is KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reporting. Thank you, Gabe.
Thank you, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. The World Health Organization says nearly 11 million people around the world were diagnosed with tuberculosis in 2023. In the early part of the 20th century, some number of those patients would have been sent to the valley for treatment in the dry air. But today, treatment options are in question for some parts of the world, even though TB is a curable disease. Author John Green has written about this. His new book is called Everything is Tuberculosis: The History and Persistence of Our Deadliest Infection. Green is known for his young adult novels, including Looking for Alaska and The Fault in Our Stars. He says he became interested in writing about this disease when he visited a TB hospital in Sierra Leone in 2019.
And it was there that I learned that TB is still the deadliest infectious disease in the world. It kills over 1.25 million people per year. And also while there, I made the acquaintance of a young boy who shared the same name as my son, whose name is Henry. And it was really following Henry's story that taught me so much about tuberculosis and helped me to see the disease in a different light and made me want to write the book that I ended up writing.
What kind of different light do you now see it in?
Well, I now understand tuberculosis as a present tense phenomenon, not just a past tense phenomenon, but also as a disease that really has followed the trails of injustice that we blazed for it. You know, the way we imagine TB and treat TB has not just shaped how people live and die of it, but also who lives and dies of it.
Is there a lot of research going into treatments or preventions of TB?
There is a fair amount of money going into treating and preventing tuberculosis, but not nearly enough. I mean, it's a paltry, paltry amount compared to the burden of the disease. And, you know, like my brother had cancer a couple years ago. He had Hodgkin lymphoma, and he was very fortunate to receive the kind of personalized, tailored treatment that, you know, you or I would expect and that all of us deserve. With TB, it's very different. A lot of times people are treated with drugs that are from 1950s, 1960s. And, you know, the newer drugs, of which there are a few, but only a few, unfortunately, are generally reserved for extraordinary cases or for people living in the rich world.
Do people in the rich world tend to still get TB? I mean, you mentioned visiting a facility in Sierra Leone. I would imagine that there's some economic disparity in terms of who gets this as well.
Oh, for sure. So we have about 10,000 cases of active tuberculosis in the U.S. every year, which is a lot, and it's been going up. But it's a tiny percentage compared to the percentage of the overall percentage of burden of the disease. So in a country like Sierra Leone, up to 1% of people will have active tuberculosis at any given time.
Wow, that seems like a lot.
It is a lot. I mean, 10 million people get sick with TB every year. It's a lot. It's a huge, you know, it's the biggest infectious disease killer in the world. And it's really horrifying to me that we don't spend more money, spend more time, spend more attention trying to fight this scourge.
When you talk about money in terms of research, is that money that's being affected by recent cuts in research grants and things like that?
Yeah, I wouldn't just say it's been affected. I would say it's been devastated by it. Research has been devastated, but also treatment has been devastated because so much of, you know, the U.S. has long been the most generous funder of tuberculosis response globally, and so much of that has gone away. And because it went away in such a sudden and chaotic, hundreds of thousands of people have seen their treatment interrupted, which is an absolute catastrophe. Most of those people will die of tuberculosis, but also they'll spread multi-drug resistant tuberculosis through their communities because a lot of those people are already under treatment. We know that if you stop treatment in the middle of your course, you're very likely to develop drug resistance. And so we're going to have a lot more complicated cases of drug resistant tuberculosis floating through our communities, which is frankly pretty terrifying.
Is the most common form of treatment still like just massive doses of antibiotics?
Yeah, so you take antibiotics every day, a cocktail of antibiotics for between 4 and 6 months for most cases of TB. And it's a really challenging process, but, you know, it is a curable disease.
Is this the kind of thing that other countries might be able to pick up either in the research or the production of medication?
I mean, certainly we all benefit from a world where there are more funders than just the United States government. That said, it's very difficult to imagine any other country picking up the slack here. It's just too much infrastructure. It was done so suddenly that other countries haven't really had an opportunity to pick up the slack or to take over some of that infrastructure, some of the underlying systems that have been key to distributing tuberculosis medications for the last 50 years. It was always assumed that the U.S. government would continue their commitments to do that. And so the sudden upending of that has really been catastrophic for people living with TB.
So is this the kind of thing, and you kind of alluded to this, that we're going to start seeing cases of tuberculosis on the rise and maybe this disease coming back in a pretty meaningful way in places like the U.S.?
Yeah, cases are already going up in the U.S., and they will go up further as the global burden of the disease rises. So I think the most recent estimate is that we can expect in the next 2 years to see, instead of 1.25 million people dying of tuberculosis, closer to 2 million people dying every year of tuberculosis. Mm. And that, you know, seeing hundreds of thousands more people die means we're seeing many millions more cases of TB, and that doesn't just affect people living in impoverished communities, it affects all of us.
So Phoenix obviously has a kind of an interesting history with tuberculosis in the sense that a lot of folks were sent here in the earlier part of the 20th century. That clearly doesn't seem to be the way this is handled anymore. But is that sort of model something that other countries are starting to look at as, you know, research funding is starting to dry up and medication maybe becomes more unavailable or unaffordable?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, Phoenix has a really fascinating and long history of being a home for consumptive people, a place where people were told to go when they were living with tuberculosis so that they could recover in dry air. The idea was that the dry air of Phoenix would kind of, you know, dry out the wet lungs of tuberculosis. And that doesn't really hold up to scrutiny, although it is true that rest and adequate nutrition are good for TB. And so, you know, any institution that can offer people adequate rest and adequate nutrition is welcome right now, I think.
So I've got to ask, because a lot of this conversation has been, frankly, a little bit of a downer. During the
yeah,
research...
Sorry.
No. I mean, it makes sense. But like, I'm curious, like, if doing the research for this book and with all the folks you talked to, were the reasons for optimism that you found?
There are so many reasons for optimism. There are millions of people working together to try to reduce the burden of tuberculosis. And I find reasons for optimism in every single survivor of TB I talk to, because they in turn become advocates for other people living with tuberculosis. Like my friend Henry eventually survived his tuberculosis treatment. And today he's an advocate for people who are patients at the hospital where he was a patient at. And he's there to tell them, you know, you can get better. You can get well. This is a curable disease. We can live in a world without tuberculosis. And I believe that someday we will live in a world without tuberculosis. It's just, it may be that the time frame has changed a little bit in the last few months.
Yeah, I'm curious, like prior to maybe, let's say, the beginning of this year, what were folks who were in this world saying is a reasonable timeline for maybe just getting rid of this disease altogether?
Some people said 2030. I think the more realistic goals were closer to 2040. But we can live in a world without tuberculosis. I mean, we've seen a 99% reduction in TB In the United States, for instance. And we know how to do this. We do it with active case finding, like in the 1950s, from Arizona to where I live in Indiana, people sent out these mobile chest x-ray vans that offered people free chest x-rays and then gave them free TB treatment if they had TB. And that's basically how we eliminated it. So we know how to do this. It's just that we have to do it at scale, and we have to do it in countries where TB is still really, really, where the rates of it are still really, really high.
All right. John Green, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Author John Green's latest book is called Everything is Tuberculosis: The History and Persistence of Our Deadliest Infection. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Hang Time, a play by Pulitzer finalist Zora Howard, will be performed this Saturday at ASU Gamage. The play depicts three black men hanging in a tree. A breeze blows intermittently, and their bodies sway as they give monologues and have conversations about their lives. I spoke with Howard about writing the play, and she told me that her goal was to channel the humanity of her characters.
I think so much of writing is listening. And when you meet these characters or they meet you, they find you and they kind of come with a story. If you are letting them lead, I found that to be the most productive way of writing, is to not try to get my words out through the vehicle of character, but to let the character speak. And sometimes they will not say the things that you want them to say. So it can be very frustrating. In a lot of ways, I feel, I don't know if this is right or wrong, I kind of feel like passive as a writer, as I'm just kind of a record keeper.
So can I ask you, when it comes to the conceit or the presentation of these three men in particular, did you first start to hear their stories and write those down, or did the concept of the three of them together in this uncertain environment, did that idea come to you first, or did their stories and their voices come to you first?
The concept came first.
Okay.
And that's usually the way it is with me. I had a colleague, and she was actually a showrunner on a room that I was one time, and she introduced this vocabulary that I found very useful about whether you're a worm or a bird. And if you're a bird, you're the kind of person that sees the larger picture first and then kind of has to dive in and get to the details and the, you know, minutia of it all. And if you're a worm, you're the opposite. You know, you start in the weeds, you start in the dirt, and then it might, you know, from there you build out the larger picture. So
interesting.
I do feel pretty consistently as a writer that I'm of the bird kind.
I am never going to forget that. Thank you for sharing that.
I never forgot it either. I was like, wow, that just really helped me a lot.
Yes.
In describing my practice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's take that idea and apply it to our three characters in Hang Time. We have Slim, Blood, and Bird. There are moments of great specificity that really stay with me for each of those characters. For me, with Bird, it's when he has the moment where he talks about Beverly.
Beverly's none of your business.
Okay.
We don't really know who Beverly is, but it's clear that Beverly is really important to him. With Blood, it's when he talks about wanting to swim in various bodies of water.
I got a red ocean somewhere, too. Water look like a jewel. Must be some kind of clean to bathe in red water.
And for Slim, for me, I think it's when he sings.
Have you ever loved the woman? So much you tremble in pain. Yeah. Have you ever loved the woman?
Those moments are all so uniquely human. How did you know when you had really arrived at something true about each of these men as you were making record, as you put it? Do you like experience that in your body as you're writing? Like how do you know, like, yes, this is it?
I mean, I do think some of it is spiritual. If I'm being completely honest about the when I'm in it, when the writing is actually happening, it's hard for me to describe, you know, what exactly is going down because I don't fully understand it myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There is a point where kind of everything in you is vibrating. That's when I think the writing comes most freely. So I'm not struggling against something or like forcing words, but they're just coming. That moment or those moments when you're like, this is something true and this is something I have to protect in the story with each of the characters. Yeah, it does feel like an embodied thing. Like,
yeah.
And those are the things I'll fight for. Obviously, with every project, there are things that you fight for and things that you must let go.
I have to say, it's eerie to hear you use that way of describing it when we're talking about this play in particular, because it strikes me that each of these men, as we watch the show, it is when they are expressing themselves most truly and most honestly that we see them start to struggle. We start to see their breath literally being cut off from their bodies.
And that is the violence that these men were full of life and full of hopes for the future and dreams and regrets and in deep relationship. And all of that kind of just was flattened. So the violence is centered. It is center stage. There's no way around it and there's nowhere else to look. But the men unto whom this violence was enacted, they are men. You have to look at the two in tandem, I think, is what the play is after. You know, because if you saw one of these men on the street corner or, you know, passing you as you were on the way to the grocery store, violence is still hovering very close to their bodies.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I want us to face. That's the thing that I'm trying to reconcile.
Well, Zora Howard is the playwright of Hang Time, which is what we've been discussing, and Hang Time will be playing at ASU Gamage on April 19th. Zora, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Sam. It was a great time.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.